We will warn them, thought Mephiston. A sense of imminence afflicted them, and they looked on in anguish as a malevolent mind reached through the veil of realities. Spectral jaws formed around the angelic blade and snapped shut. A blood-red psychic storm wreathed the ships. A terrible scream resounded through the warp, blasting Mephiston with the anguish of dozens of warriors lost to madness together. The angelic blade listed, falling off its course. The flame of Baal vented atmosphere from a dozen deep gashes in its flanks and steamed ahead, pulling away from its sister. All this would have taken hours in real time. Mephiston and Rasselas watched as it happened, but they were divorced from the mortal realm, and time moved differently for them. Warp engines made bright tracks upon the psychic firmament as vessels forced their way into real space, arriving moments after the storm that assailed their brothers. The markings of the 1st, 2nd, and 7th companies of the Blood Angels were displayed upon them. It should have been an uplifting sight to see their brothers safe through the Immaterium and heading to war, but other powers wished them stopped. The arriving fleet stood off from the angelic blade. Uncertainty colored the warp. Seeing something was amiss, the vessels Dante had sent from Cryptus sped towards their beleaguered brothers. A sorrowing mind reached out to touch theirs, groping through the psychic backlash.
I have SS mail,
thought Rasselas, his mind strained at the pain of making contact at such distances. He and Mephiston struggled to hear Asasmael's voice. His presence was snatched away before he could impart a sense of what had happened. The drumbeat rippling of empirical disturbance intensified. Fell intelligences noticed Rasselas and Mephiston's astral presences and turned their attention upon them.
Enough, said Mephiston.
Mephiston's eyes snapped open. Without pausing for breath, he thrust himself from the throne, waved down a vox cherub, and began issuing orders.
Marcello, send word to the relay on Baal Secundus. Have our astropaths focus their attentions upon the Diamor system. Let the Librarius aid them. Find Carlaine and the rest.
My lord, said Epistory Marcello's voice from the silver lips of the cherub.
Something terrible has happened to the task force, he said to Rasselas. We must speak with Asasmael. We shall go to the relay on Baal Secundus and enlist Master Leta's aid.
There is worse on the way, said Rasselas.
He shut his glowing eyes and rubbed behind his skull, scratching at the interface sockets of his psychic hood.
Yes, said Mephiston absently, his mind drifting back to the vision of Carbanda.
This element of his vision he would share only with a chapter master.
Far worse. Commander Dante must be informed.
Chapter 5. Blade of Vengeance.
Is it not glorious? Said Erwin,
his teeth pricked at his lips in anticipation.
As you say, Captain, said Ackerman.
Erwin stood free of his throne, trusting to the servile locum to run the command systems for him. He and Ackerman were fully armed for battle. Erwin wore a power sword belted to his side. A boxy storm bolter hung from a strap around his right shoulder, the gun being too big to maglock to his battle plate. 15 of his tactical marines stood at various points around the bridge, guns in their hands. They expected to be boarded. They wanted it. The splendid pinion cut its way through space towards a world shrouded in a cloud of tyrannic spacecraft. From 50,000 miles out, the aliens looked like a swarm of nocturnal insects mobbing a lumen.
Numbers, demanded Erwin.
47,000 destroyer class and larger bioships, my lord, said the servile of the watch dryly, or thereabouts.
Imperial numbers, said Erwin.
2 battle barges, the Blade of Vengeance, Blood Angels, and the Crimson Tear. Angels numinous.
The Blade of Vengeance itself, said Erwin eagerly.
Ackerman gave him a morose look. He lacked the proper enthusiasm.
6 strike cruisers, the servile of the watch went on, and 35 escort craft.
Is that it? Said Erwin incredulously.
Those are impossible odds, said Ackerman. We cannot win.
Ah, our brothers in the blood are not seeking victory,
said Erwin.
Look.
Bursts of light marked out battle in the encircling shroud of the High Fleet. The ships of the Imperium were invisible at that distance, but the destruction they meted out was not. Spheres of dazzling light enveloped alien craft, blasting holes in the swarm. Twinkles of an unleashed broadside sparked in the shifting clouds of Xenos ships.
Impossible odds, repeated Ackerman. The Tyranids are not the target, said Erwin.
Shockwaves rippled through the atmosphere of Zozan Tertius. A circle of the sky turned black. Its expanding circumference crackled with violent electrical storms, and the center glowed, the telltale sign of planet death by cyclonucleonic fire.
Exterminatus, said Ackerman, bleakly. The Cryptman solution, said Erwin. Starve the Horde. The situation must be desperate if a noble heart like Commander Dante would consider the death of worlds. Serve out a response. Send them a message. Hololithic transmission, commanded Erwin. Commit primary projector to the purpose. Maximum boost.
Yes, my lord,
said the servile of response. The strategic display winked out over the main hololith pit, and its stylized representation of the void was picked up by lesser tacticaria. In its place a pale sphere glowed, gradually coalescing into the ghostly shape of a Blood Angel's fleet officer.
Greetings, my brother, said Erwin. I am Captain Erwin, second company of the Angels Excelsis and commander of the Splendid Pinion. We answer your call for aid.
I am Brother Asante, fleet captain of the Blade of Vengeance.
Noise spilled from the Blade of Vengeance's command deck crowded the audio channel. Interference from Tyranid jamming beasts interrupted the visual, causing his face to momentarily freeze and jump apart to blurred image blocks.
Your presence is welcome, said Asante.
His words smeared into one another. The sound of voices and ship's guns swelled in the background.
We are preparing to fall back. Cover our rear.
Asante's image flickered out.
Get him back, commanded Erwin.
My lord, there is heavy interference on all frequencies. Our communications are being targeted.
I care not for reasons. Do as I command. Bring the captain back.
The servile of response worked as best he could with Erwin glaring at him. Servitors moaned and gave out their monotone reports. A hololith crackled, and Asante burst back into existence.
These coordinates. Come to a halt and prepare for further orders.
Asante half moved out of the projection field, shouting orders that the crew of the Splendid Pinion could not hear. Behind Asante's wavering head, the battle had filled the oculus. Zozan Tertius's blackening orb filled most of the great window, the fires of its death creeping round the far side. The ships of the High Fleet were revealed as void leviathans, things with curled shells and mouths of writhing tentacles, or bodies like slugs, covered in asteroidal rock glued into place over their skin, like the aquatic larvae of predatory insects. The variety of craft in the swarm was astounding. The Tyranids had weight classes to match every vessel the Imperium possessed, from individual fighters to capital ships and more besides. The planet's orbit was crammed with Xenos life propelled by gas plumes. Darts of gristle and bone took the place of torpedoes, fast-hunting beasts driven by bioplasma jets replaced interceptors. Long, whale-like carrier beasts ejected spores and hunter-killers from their sides by the thousand. The Tacticaria hololiths were a red blizzard of life signs. Asante looked back into his hololith imager.
Asante, out.
Friendly, said Erwin.
He's preoccupied, said Ackerman. You know, when the Emperor's gifts were implanted into your body, Ackerman, I think they left out the organ responsible for a sense of humor. Where is your joy? We go into battle. There is only room for duty in my heart.
You have two, Erwin reminded him.
The other is full of sorrow for the people of our Imperium, said Ackerman.
Erwin made an exasperated noise.
Put the tactical display back on the main hololith. Do we have the captain's coordinates?
Yes, my lord,
said the servile of the watch. The glowing sphere of the tactical hololith took place at the center of the deck again. Upon it, a blue signifier blinked amid the swirling mess of Tyranid life signs. A dotted line described the Splendid Pinion's track, as desired by Captain Asante. Erwin leaned on the railing around the command throne's dais. He stared at the suggested course intently for several minutes, as the splendid pinion hurtled towards the devouring swarm.
"Not there," said Irwin finally.
"My lord," said the servile locum.
"Asante gave us orders," said Ackerman. "The last time I looked, you wore the winged axe of the angels Excelsis upon your pauldron, and not the blood drip of Baal," said Irwin.
"He is not of our chapter, I admit, but he has seniority," said Ackerman.
"You would obey him, then?"
"They are our chapter founder.
Asante is renowned across the segmentum as a talented void commander. He commands a battle barge. We go to the aid of the blood angels. Yes, I would obey him for these and many other reasons, brother."
"Well,
I will not," said Irwin. "Not until Lord Folodark tells me that I must abandon my judgment and blindly follow another's. Asante's withdrawal is flawed. They will be cut off by these two groupings. Here."
Irwin worked a console with buttons sized for his armored hands, his fingers clacking on the plastic. Additional indicators leapt onto the hololith.
"Do you see? These movements look random, but they're not. There is a predation pattern concealed within it. If he breaks the way he says he will, his trailing vessels will be cut off and destroyed."
Ackerman scrutinized the graphics thrown up by his captain onto the display.
"Why did Asante not see it? Maybe he is not as fine a commander as you say he is, though I shall be charitable and attribute the oversight to his preoccupation with the battle. Servile of the helm, take us on this heading."
Irwin, not linked to the ship's systems directly while he was out of the throne, was once again obliged to use physical interfaces to display his desired path on the hololith.
"Bring us down to quarter speed. Turn 75 degrees. Present our port flank to the swarm. Maintain an oblique heading towards the main body of the fleet. Servile belligerent, have all our weapons brought online, loaded and standing by. Servile Scutus, activate void shields. Increase reactor output to maximum. I will need all our speed and all our power."
His crew obeyed. The constant reactor vibration, that machine shake that stood in for a heartbeat, increased in frequency. Alarms and notification toxins sounded and were duly silenced.
"Now we will see if it is I or Asante who is the better voidsman," said Irwin with relish.
By now, the blackness of planet death had spread its way across all of Zozan Tertius. Lava bombs cracked the crust, shockwaves did the rest. Smoke obscured the face of the world. The void dimmed as Zozan's planet shine went out, swallowed by a global pall of smoke. The blade of vengeance and the crimson tear broke and ran. Space marine craft moved surprisingly quickly for ships of such mass. They turned about and reordered their formation, strike cruisers making a hollow box around the two battle barges. They moved off even as they maneuvered, all weapons blazing at the Tyranid swarms. Now the planet was in its death throes. Lance batteries made a deadly lattice of laser beams around the battle group. Pinpoint torpedo strikes destroyed high-priority threats. The Hive Fleet sent wave after wave of grapple-armed nautiloids at the battle barges, but the space marines aboard maintained a punishing rate of fire. Planet-killing bombardment cannons gutted hundreds of bioplanes. The Tyranids had no protective energy fields, relying on sheer numbers to overwhelm their foe. Within minutes, the clouds of broken flesh and frozen fluids already around the space marine fleet had thickened considerably. The space marines powered away from the planet, a sphere of Tyranids around them. The swarm distorted as the space marines moved off and thousands of bioships followed them, dragging the teeming life forms around the world into a teardrop.
"The enemy is confounding our allies," said Irwin. "They are blinding them. Observe, the groups I indicated make their play as predicted. There is a weakness at the rear of the enemy interception. They seek to tempt our brothers to make a swift run from their attackers. Of course, Asante will see that as a trap, but will be forced to exploit it anyway."
"And so they will be driven right into the arms of the approaching subswarm," said Ackerman, with dawning realization. Irwin nodded.
"Did I not suggest this would happen? We should warn them."
"We should," said Irwin.
"I doubt it will be possible."
Ackerman frowned.
"We should at least try. Servile of response. What say you?"
The servile of response went round his small kingdom of desks and cyborg slaves with nervous efficiency.
"We cannot, my lord. The enemy employ total band inhibitor broadcasts."
"So you see, You are not a foolish warrior, Ackerman, but you over-rely on those who command you. You make assumptions about situations, about what those above you know. You can think beyond these restrictions. Yours is a fine mind. If you are ever to become captain, you must transcend these limitations. You have too little confidence in your own abilities.
The splendid pinion rushed across space. The hive mind finally deigned to pay attention to this new, negligible threat. Brass grisk counter-dials clicked upwards. Servitors pedantically mumbled out unfavorable odds. On the hololith, two blots comprising hundreds of ships broke away from the world and made directly for the splendid pinion.
"Enemy moving to intercept," said the servile of the watch.
"Hold course and hold fire," ordered Irwin. "You're taking us directly into the tail of a pursuit swarm," said Ackerman. "As is my intention, Senior Sergeant," said Irwin. "Now the swarm. See how the assembled ships of the Blood Angels and the Angels Numinous attempt to break through the weakness in the encirclement sphere. See how the enemy is ready to respond."
Through the oculus, the feigned weak spot in the encirclement sphere cracked with a light of macro-cannon bombardment. A wall of Tyranid constructs blew apart, and from the interior sailed the Space Marines' fleet.
"Now watch how their hindmost vessel," Irwin looked questioningly at the servile of the watch.
"The Staff of Light, my lord."
"Watch how the Staff of Light is sure to be caught." "It is damaged," said Irwin. He brought up a magnified view and circled plasma venting from its drive stack with a quick movement of his finger over a gel screen interface. "Your vaunted Captain Asante has not seen this. See how desperately they run to keep up. They are doomed."
The sun welled around the black edge of Zozan Tertius, haloed through the densely packed Tyranids. Realizing their prey world had been rendered inedible, the governing mind of the swarm disengaged the rest of the splinter fleet from the planet and set a pursuit course for the Imperial ships. The Xenos had no chance of gaining on the human vessels, and so those set to trap them were redirected to close surely around the Staff of Light. The numbers attacking the battle barges and other ships dwindled. Asante's task force pulled free, though they remained under heavy fire. Void shields blinked and flickered. Auspex banks warbled aboard the command deck of the splendid pinion at their collapse. An escort cruiser peeled away from the formation, fire streaming from it as its atmosphere burned up and broke apart.
"Asante's making a run for safe translation distance," said Ackerman.
"If we follow his orders..."
"His suggestion, Ackerman,"
interrupted Irwin.
"His suggestion, then. We shall also be safe, and we can cover their retreat. That was his intention."
Irwin watched Asante's fleet pull away, leaving the lagging Staff of Light further behind. Hundreds of hive ships were turning from the pursuit and falling like pelagic predators on bleeding prey.
"Do we wish to lose however many of our bloodline brothers are aboard that ship?" said Irwin.
"No, my lord," said Ackerman.
"No, indeed. So, watch me save them. Full speed ahead. Servile belligerent, prepare to open fire. All weapons."
Two battle barges punching their way out of total encirclement was a spectacle to be remembered. Broadsides rippling, they annihilated thousands of the Tyranid ships mobbing them. Void shields burned with purple fire. Tyranid torpedoes and boarding spines flashed into nothing, shunted into the warp by ancient technologies, or their atoms sundered and the energies caged inside set loose in blinding flashes of annihilated matter. Strike cruisers and escort craft operated around the paired leviathans, protecting the battle barges' more vulnerable approaches, but it was the battle barges that did the majority of the work, efficiently sectioning the three-dimensional battlefield between them and filling it with a punishing barrage. Macro cannons lobbed time-fuse munitions into the midst of Tyranid attack squadrons. Fusion beamers burned across space, slicing apart ship after ship before shutting off, then firing again.
"Look at that," said Irwin. "Asante is running his fusion beams to the overheating threshold. His gun crews must be exemplary."
He raised his voice.
"See, serviles, that is how a real ship is run. Take note."
Plasma projectors sent out shorter-lived rays of energy, solar bright and damaging to the eyes of those who looked at them.
"Yes," said Irwin. "Asante deserves his reputation. But no man is perfect."
Irwin pointed an armored finger at the Staff of Light. It was increasingly isolated at the edge of the fleet.
Tyranid response squadrons turned back from the assault on the main battle group and bore down on it.
Servile of the helm, take us on direct intercept course for the Staff of Light. Open fire now as we close. Make me a hole in the Xenos so that we might come alongside and help them.
The Angel's Numina strike cruiser was of the same class as the Splendid Pinion, albeit of a different pattern. The variation of its armament and shape was superficial. It had the same blocky rear hull containing the engines, main weapons, and fighter bays. A short neck housed bombardment cannon batteries, embarkation deck and drop ports. Its flat prow was protected by a pair of blast shields, giving it a hammer-headed appearance. The Staff of Light was a pale grey with vermilion shields. The Splendid Pinion was bright white with red accents. They were sisters, and the Splendid Pinion rushed to help its beleaguered sibling.
Send a message to Captain Asante. Inform him we're moving to aid the Staff of Life.
There is extensive interference still, my lord. I cannot raise them, said the servile of response.
Keep trying.
Yes, my lord. My lord,
said the servile of the watch,
the Staff of Light has lost its shields. The enemy are boarding in strength.
We should leave them. Asante will have had his reasons, said Ackerman.
They watched as hundreds of Tyranid assault spores rushed at the ship. But it was not done yet, and most were burst apart by point-defense weaponry.
They're still firing, said Erwin. The Blood Angels may condone this sacrifice, but I will not. Serviles, how lies the field for pulsed laser communication?
Possible, but difficult, my lord, said the servile of response. There is a great deal of debris between us that will corrupt data bursts or disperse them completely.
Then they will be surprised to see us. Ackerman, summon your squad and Orsini's. Have them report to the drop deck. Servile belligerent, target preference for boarding spines. Take us in closer. The shorter distance our boarding torpedoes must go, the better it'll be. Shelter the Staff of Light as much as possible with our void shields. Keep attempting communication with both Captain Asante and the Staff of Light. See if you can form a data bridge, so we might coordinate our fire.
The sparse human crew gave a chorus of yes, my lord, as each order was passed down the chain of command. The Staff of Light rolled in the oculus as the Splendid Pinion sailed over it. The grey skin of the hull was pocked with acid burns all along its length, particularly towards the rear port side. Whipping tendrils disappeared into maggot holes 20 yards across as boarding spines wriggled their way through the ship's armour and into the interior in search of meat. With the two ships firing in tandem, the immediate space around the two vessels was cleared, although some of the small Tyranid craft running ahead of the main fleet got through, while the wall of wriggling tentacles and calloused flesh blotting out the dying world of Zozan was gaining on them.
Ackerman, we have to go now. Servile Locum, you have command.
My lord!
The Servile Locum activated his command station. The crew of the bridge reoriented their attention to him.
Come, Ackerman, said Erwin. Let us show the Angels Numinous how the Angels Excelsis fight. Serviles, maintain bombardment. We do not depart until every one of the Angels Numinous is aboard the Splendid Pinion, or their ship is free of the swarm.
3 boarding torpedoes burned through the spinal way of the Staff of Life. Melter arrays whooshed. The air shimmered with heat and molten metal ran down the walls. The torpedoes shuddered as their track units shut off and the melter arrays cut out. For a second, quiet returned. Guns boomed in the distance, shaking the ship. Molten plasteel glowed from white to orange to red in the unlit corridor. Metal pinked as it cooled. Explosive bolts blew on the torpedoes' prows, smashing their access ramps down with enough force to push away any final obstruction. Erwin and his men deployed rapidly and were immediately confronted by a tumbling spill of attack organisms. Hissing things the size of human children sped at them from both ends of the way, long scythe limbs raised and ready to kill. Bolters opened fire before the metal slag created by the Angel's Excelsis' landing had hardened. Bolt propulsion flares strobed the dim spinal corridor. The battlefield was dark, full of acrid fumes, but the Space Marines could barely miss. Their bolts ploughed into a crowd of aliens, blasting internal organs to pulp, and sending shattered chitin cracking off the walls. Creatures behind their fallen broodmates slipped on spilled entrails. The Tyranids came on regardless, heedlessly tramping the fallen. Despite the toll the Space Marines took on the beasts,
they continued to advance quickly from both stem and prow of the ship, leaping over one another in their mindless haste to close. The Angel's Excelsis adopted a standard spread order as they fired, forming into two loose skirmish lines back to back. They stood with 2-yard gaps between each space marine so that their lines covered about half the width of the spinal way. The lines bent back at each end, and the brothers anchoring the ends stood with their backpacks almost touching. With the space marine's position adjusted, Xenos fell like crops before the harvester. Registering their losses, the swarm abruptly changed tactics. Large numbers of them switched direction simultaneously, heading for the open edges of the corridor to box the space marines in, while yet more poured forward directly at their prey's guns to tie them up. Not one of the creatures got within striking distance. For a full minute, the space marines fired, each battle brother keeping to his own pace, reloading when necessary, covering his squad mates when it was needed. Despite the number of beasts attacking them, the space marines sighted every burst carefully, their adapted brains making microsecond adjustments so that all their rounds hit their mark.
"Cease fire!" shouted Irwin.
The last bolt round banged out of a gun and rushed down the hall, detonating with a flash some way away. Then all was still. Piles of Xenos bodies confronted them. No more came. Physoline smoke merged with the greasy metal vapors occasioned by their entry. Irwin lowered his storm bolter and pushed a dog-like alien over with his boot. 2 of its 4 arms were missing. Yellow ichor dribbled from the wounds.
"Gaunt strain," he said.
He looked down the way towards the main section. Very much like the spinal cord on his own ship, it was 40 yards across and almost as high. Tracks for ship trains ran down the middle, and the ceiling was crammed with hundreds of pipes and conduits as dense as a rhizome mat. There was a screeching coming from a corridor off the way. The ship shook to the discharge of its guns and the impact of Tyranid spores.
"Where are the angels, Numinous?" he said.
He switched his vox to unciphered broadcast.
"This is Captain Irwin of the Angels Excelsis. If our brothers of the Angels Numinous are present, declare yourselves. We have come to retrieve you from the ship."
He got only static back in reply.
"Auspex," Irwin said. "Give me a lifeform scan."
Sergeant Orsini unclamped a handheld Auspex from his leg and keyed it into activation. Its gentle pinging robbed some of the fury from the muffled noise of war. The sergeant sent the results directly to the captain's sensorium.
"There are concentrations of life ahead, my lord. I would say the enemy," said Orsini. "Nothing else. Minor returns on fixed organisms to either side of us. Gun deck servitors, I would guess."
Irwin made a thoughtful noise.
"We shall head to the command deck and secure it. Someone is still aboard this vessel, directing its operations." "Forward!"
They ran down the spinal corridor, covering the mile and a half to the main hull quickly. The life signs were concentrated around the juncture of the ship's neck and its stern command section. Irwin ordered his men to slow as the glowing red indicator of enemy life signs drew close on his cartilage. Sure enough, they saw the foe with their own eyes soon enough. A bulkhead hid the first of them, but on passing, they were confronted with a Tyranid boarding spine dying in the wall. It was a large ship animal, the heavy armor to its fore generously provided with tubules for the venting of acid. Its fore parts looked like a spearhead, designed to penetrate its target, with the ridged, layered armor plates covering it, acting as barbs to prevent it being drawn out. Now it was aboard. It had lost its predatory sleekness. Its head had been flung open into 4 quarters after penetrating the vessel, an action that appeared to have been fatal to the beast itself. The armor had opened along seams that were cracked and splintered in a way that meant they could never rejoin, and the skin and muscles underneath were torn. Tentacles hanging from the interior flopped weakly against each other, not even attempting to grasp the space marines. Mucus dripped from its torn gullet. The thing had no guts of its own. The fleshy cavity where its internal organs should have been was occupied instead by transit bladders hanging from gristly fibers. What it had transported was impossible to judge. Acid leaked from ducts, melting a wide hole in the floor and sending up a choking smog from the dissolving metal that stirred in the ventilation systems. The Auspex indicated that there were more of the spines hanging from the wall further along. Irwin slowed his men.
"Something is moving in this mess.
Be prepared.
Guns clacked as the Angels Excelsis pulled their bolters into sighting position. Irwin moved forward, slowly. His helm plate display blinked up cautionary amber screed as acidic fog condensed on his armor. There was enough corrosiveness left in the fumes to damage his battle plate's soft seals if he remained in it too long.
There! Shouted Ackerman.
Bolt shots followed his word. The fog came alive with screeching shapes. Multi-limbed Xenos nightmares poured forth. Their horrific appearance was made all the worse by a superficial resemblance to humanity. Brother Golas of Squad Ackerman filled the corridor with promethium. There was no time for restraint. He emptied the entire flask of his flamer. Gene Stealers fell back, covered in fire, arms flailing, and their screeches were horribly human. The Gene Stealers were the worst of the enemy's weapons, infiltration biomorphs who perverted the breeding cycles of the creatures they came across. Most of those Irwin had fought had shown the mark of human genetics, from their noses, perpetually wrinkled in hate, to their grasping hands. They ran in a hunched parody of men. Irwin's gorge rose at this perversion of the sacred Terran form.
"Hate the alien," he pronounced,
shooting down a purple-faced monster as it came at him, clawed limbs outstretched. Gene Stealers were harder to kill than Gaunts. Their bodies were toughened inside and out to withstand combat. Their armor was thicker, their organs more deeply buried. The lower pair of arms carried huge, human-like hands, capable of ripping away a Space Marine's helmet in one strike. But what made the creatures most dangerous were their upper claws, a trio of conical spikes with monomolecular edges. No other Tyranid biomorph was more suited to tearing through ceramite. Even the thick plates of Terminator armor offered little protection against a well-placed blow. To standard power armor, they were deadly. A Gene Stealer sprang off its powerful back legs, upper claws outstretched to disembowel the captain. Irwin slashed with his power sword, cleaving three of the four arms from the monster's body. Still, it lived, crashing into him, severed arms weeping thick blood. Its taloned feet scraped at his armor, scoring the paint and scratching the metal beneath. The remaining upper claw swept around in an attempt to punch through Irwin's eye lenses. Irwin opened fire, and the beast lifted back at the last moment, spine breaking apart from within and showering viscera all over its broodmates. Irwin shook the corpse free from the end of his gun and held aloft his sword.
Slay them all! Once they are dead, the way is clear. Purge the alien. The stars belong to mankind.
The Gene Stealers would not die easily. They were wickedly fast, dodging blows that should have hit and responded with devastating speed. Brother Agnarus clove into the chitinous exoskeleton of one with his chainsword, only to be eviscerated by another as the toothed blade bucked and roared, stuck fast in the corpse of his victim. A Gene Stealer fell from the ceiling, landing on Brother Christo of Ackerman's squad. Christo staggered backwards, firing behind him as the Gene Stealer embraced him in all four arms, then wrenched off his head, an insolent sneer on its hybrid features. Blood spouted high from Christo's neck. The scent made Irwin's spittle run down his chin. His desire to get at the blood and lap it up sharpened his reflexes, even while it clouded his mind with rage.
Slay! Slay! Slay by the blood! By the great angel!
He shouted the chapter war cry, his storm bolter bucking ferociously in his hand as it let out a stream of mass reactives, blasting Gene Stealers away from his warriors and laying low those loping through the chemical fog towards the fight.
Death! Death to Xenos! Honor the Emperor through your slaughter!
Bellowed Irwin. He ran at a Gene Stealer about to decapitate one of his embattled brothers and cut it clean in half with a single blow. He was so focused on his brothers that one of the foe almost took him unawares with a charge from the side. It was already wounded, a bolt crater in its stomach bleeding freely, but it was not weakened, and it barged Irwin off his feet. The captain twisted, landing on his back, sword across his front. The Gene Stealer pounced on him as he struggled to get upright. One huge humanoid fist closed around his right hand. Long fingers scrabbled for his sword hilt. He could have sworn the thing smiled at him as it flicked the power stud of his blade, killing the disruption field. It kept Irwin's hand tightly gripped in its own, preventing him from reactivating his weapon. The thing bared black teeth,
its hollow tongue emerging from its maw and smearing saliva across his helmet. Erwin wrestled with it, bracing its lower hands with his dead power sword, but it was far stronger than its wiry body suggested, and the combined effort of his muscles and armor could not shift it. It drew back its upper claws, ready to strike. The thing took to a triplet of bolt impacts. Still hissing, it fell sideways from his chest. Ackerman came to his side. Firing his bolter one-handed into the jerking body of the gene-stealer, the sergeant extended his other hand to Erwin. The captain let his storm bolter hang by its strap and grasped his second's wrist. His stabilization jets blasted heated vapor to help him stand.
"Careful, Captain," said Ackerman.
Then he was away again, bolter barking death. Erwin howled with rage. The first tightened its hold over him, goading him into closer quarters with his enemy. His sword crackled with renewed power, and he swung it in wide arcs as he charged into the foe, its shining edge blurring into an electric crescent with a speed. Several more of the creatures fell to his wrath before the combat calmed, and the enemy backed away from his rage. They hissed and snapped at him, but they would not come near. Stealthily they withdrew into the chemical fog. Ackerman's bolter banged behind him. The shattered remains of a gene stealer fell from the ceiling, splashing black blood over the party.
"My lord! The Tyranids are retreating!"
shouted the foremost space marine. Shouts of astonishment and rapid bolt-gun fire followed the gene stealer's unexpected withdrawal. A burst of gunfire, another, then silence. The space marines broke forward to fall in line with their foremost brother, guns up, repairing a formation disrupted by combat.
"They are wiser than the rest of their kin," said Ackerman. "Cunning is not wisdom," growled Erwin.
He was struggling now to contain the thirst. He forced it back. He had to concentrate. If he gave in, he would doom his warriors to a glorious but pointless death. He steadied himself with the appropriate catechisms.
"Nor is rage," said Ackerman. "What are your orders?"
6 mortis runes pulsed on Erwin's helm plate. White and red armored bodies lay among the numerous alien dead.
"Withdraw the dead from this fog, or their gene seed may be lost. We will retrieve the bodies on our return. Erect a teleport, Homer, in case we do not come back this way."
In all likelihood, the bodies would be lost should they attempt to teleport them back, but a slender chance was better than forfeiting the gene seed for sure. His men moved into action, not needing to be told who would perform which task. They smoothly broke into 2 groups, one covering, the others dragging their dead brothers from the midst. One space marine took a pack and a tube from his waist. In seconds, he had removed a Homer's components from its packaging and erected the machine. A red light blinked on top of a pole, and a sense of disquiet emanated in pulses from its humming body.
"Complete, my lord. We press on to the command deck," he said, pointing through the fog. "Keep your guard up."
The ship shook to a massive impact. Ackerman glanced back towards the prow.
"That was no explosion." "We must hurry," said Erwin. "Scan for survivors. Once we have reached the command deck, we return to the splendid pinion. I will not lose my own ship."
They ran past the bodies of the other Tyranid boarding spines. Erwin found the technology aberrant, if it could be termed technology. Whatever creatures had been devoured to make the spines had been enslaved in the most profound and total way. There was no denying their efficacy, however. The spines had hit the void ship precisely enough to avoid the gun decks lining the deck, then chewed and melted their way through yards of armor to reach the corridor, before dying in a frenzy of disgorgement. Past the last creature, the acid fog cleared, and they came to the heavily protected approach to the command tower. Heavy bolter emplacements tracked them as they walked by. Imperial signum codes, broadcast by their armor, were all that protected them from the mechanisms. Fragments of flesh hung from every surface. Chitin cracked under their feet. In that space, the Tyranids had been so thoroughly obliterated, it was impossible to say what manner of beast the remains had come from. Ahead lay the adamantium doors leading into the command deck. A large siege beast slumped dead against the acid-scarred metal, its cranium cored out by lascannon beams.
"Form a cordon, Sergeant Orsini. Get that door open."
"Yes, Captain,"
said the sergeant. He hurried to the door, maglocked his weapon to his thigh, and took out his Auspex. He held its head towards the door center.
The machine spirits are in communion, my lord.
The ship shook violently again. The space marines staggered as it was pushed off course.
We should leave now, said Ackerman. Being my second gives you no right to question me, said Irwin. Open the door.
The Auspex chimed. Giant pistons in the walls hissed, and the doors opened, following their complicated sequence, each layer peeling back and revealing another that opened at a different angle. The first slid sideways, the second diagonally, the third vertically. Before they had retracted fully, the space marines ducked through, ready for whatever they might discover. Silence greeted them. Servitors worked mutely. Machines made their quiet noises. The oculus was closed. The only sign of battle was the deck trembling to the firing of guns. Irwin and Ackerman advanced ahead of their troops. Orsini ordered the rest of their party to spread out.
There is no one here. We have risked our lives for a decoy, said Ackerman in disbelief.
He marched his way to the Enginarium station. The mindless servitors ignored him.
Their warp engine is damaged along with the main motive drive. Brother Irwin, they left this ship behind on purpose. Of course there is no one here. This is an obvious diversion.
The Angels Excelsis raised their guns, training them unerringly on the source of the voice. A warrior in armor the color of drying blood stepped out from among ranked cogitator banks. His power sword was inactive, but ready. With him were five heavily armed chapter serfs, their faces covered with full mask helmets, and a spindly navigator almost as tall as the space marine. His limbs were so thin, a strong draft would break them. The reinforcement braces at his joints were probably the only things keeping him upright. His hands were overly large, and the fingers webbed, his forehead covered with a black bandana.
"Declare yourself," said Irwin. "Sergeant Hennen of the Angels Numinous. What are you doing hiding here?" "Waiting to die," said the warrior. "Someone had to oversee the servitors, so they kept up a good rate of fire. My plan was to surprise the enemy when they boarded. Instead, I have surprised an impetuous rescuer who does not know how to listen to orders." "Captain Asante is not my commander," said Irwin. "Then you should have paid attention to good sense, Captain," said Hennen. "Respect should have made you hearken. Now you've put your ship in danger when only this one would have been lost. Our main drive malfunctioned, damaging the warp engine in the process. There was no choice but to abandon it. Had the others delayed to shelter this ship, they would have been lost, as you will soon discover. Everyone else left. You are too late, Captain Irwin." "What about the serfs?" said Irwin. "And him?"
He pointed his gun at the navigator.
"Why is he still here?" "These men were of the same mind as I," said the Angel Numinous. "Better to die in honor than flee in shame. My navigator here..."
"I may speak for myself, Sergeant."
The mutant had a high, sexless voice. There was a hint of pain to it. As a psychic being, such close contact with the hive mind would be causing him great discomfort.
"I am pledge bonded to this vessel. I cannot leave by the laws of my house."
"That is a waste," said Ackerman. "So is throwing away your ship and company attempting to rescue an obvious decoy vessel," said Hennen. "Your ship has served its purpose. Come with us. We can at least save you." "I vow to end my days here. I will not break my oath."
Irwin had little to say in reply. He was shamed by his impulsiveness. There was only one way he could see to regain his honor. He and Hennen stared at each other.
"You need not lose your ship," he said. "Asante did not see it that way," said Hennen. "The situation has changed." "We can die together," said the sergeant. "We can live together," said Irwin. "Are your other systems still operational?" "More or less." "Then we can make a break for the warp," said Irwin. "We can open the rift with our engines. You can follow us in. You have your navigator still. Once inside the immaterium, you will be able to follow us and re-emerge when we do."
"What he says is possible, though difficult, Sergeant," said the navigator. "It is a chance. We should take it."
"I appreciate that you have an overwhelming desire to live if you can, Navigator Maeus," said Hennen. "But we will never make it to a safe distance from Zozan. We will be overtaken." "Who said anything about a safe distance?" said Irwin. "We can translate here."
You are impetuous, Captain. The mass interference of all these tyrannids will rip our ships to pieces.
It might. It almost certainly will.
It is better than dying, said Irwin.
So you would trade the certainty of saving one ship for the possibility of saving two?
Consider there is also the possibility of saving none.
If my ship runs now, we will probably lose it anyway, said Irwin.
The probability of your survival alone is higher than our survival together, said Hennen.
Where is your fighting spirit, Sergeant?
Under control, said Hennen.
Are you, Captain?
The ship lurched again. The movement was big enough to register against the grav plating of the ship.
You're running out of time, said Irwin. Decide. I can save you.
Hennen stared back, his helmet masking his expression.
Very well, we shall try. And when we die, we shall at least drag millions of these Xenos spawn into the warp.
Do you still have shuttlecraft?
A few, said Hennen.
Then if your hangars are clear, I request that we might borrow them and return to our vessel.
5 more Angel's Excelsis fell on their way to the staff of Life's hangar bays, cut down by gene-stealers and other worse things. But Irwin was conveyed to safety, and 40 minutes after he departed the staff's bridge, he strode back onto the command deck of the Splendid Pinion. The void outside the ship was crowded with Tyranid attack craft, living and dead. The Splendid Pinion was free of assault beasts. The same could not be said of the Staff of Light. A shelled bio-ship had the front of the ship firmly in its tentacles and was biting at the prow shields with a giant beak. The size of the thing was difficult to comprehend. Few creatures grew to such a size by any natural process or could withstand the rigors of the void.
"Send a data squirt to Captain Asante," said Irwin. "Inform him we have the Staff of Light under our protection and will attempt a tandem emergency translation."
"You are insane," said Ackerman.
"Only those who are insane have strength enough to prosper. Only those who prosper truly judge what is sane," responded Ackerman.
"Then you know the Prestican thinkers."
"I never said that I agree with them," said Ackerman.
"If this works, Captain, I swear I shall pay great attention to your every word. If it fails, I would like to say in advance, I told you so."
Irwin looked at his second in command.
"So, you do know how to jest."
Ackerman removed his helmet, revealing a face sheened with combat sweat. His expression was entirely humorless.
"I do not jest,"
Irwin shrugged.
"All power to the main drive," he ordered. "Prepare immaterial drive for emergency translation. Intensify forward fire. Serve our belligerent, remove that creature from the prow of the Staff of Life."
"Yes, my lord. Gunnery stations, prepare fusion beamers and plasma casters for maximum discharge,"
ordered the servile belligerent.
Irwin's command sent his human crew into action. They were tense, but worked efficiently, their fear at imminent death kept in check by their training.
"Servile of the helm, take us forward."
"Course, my lord."
Irwin grinned inside his helmet.
"Into the heart of the swarm."
The Splendid Pinion's engines burst into life, their backwash incinerating a score of Tyranid vessels attempting a stern approach. Irwin's vessel slid forward smoothly relative to the Staff of Life. The creature wrapped around the prow spewed streams of gas from vents along the curve of its shell, shoving the Staff of Life sideways. The stress of this movement could snap a ship in two, and the vessel had little choice but to roll with the beast while attempting to move forward.
"Spinal gunnery station, stand by!" shouted the servile belligerent.
The Tyranid beast was huge in the oculus, moving out of view as the Splendid Pinion passed it by. Irwin watched its grainy image captured on the hololith and tacticaria.
"Fire! Full strike!"
said the servile belligerent. The shells and void-pocked flesh of Tyranids all around the Splendid Pinion lit up harshly as a dozen energy cannons let fire. Beams of plasma slammed into the shell of the grappling kraken, charring it through to the core. Fusion beams flash-cooked the soft tissue within, then rendered it into ash. But the creature did not die. It convulsed, gripping the ship harder than ever, before a second volley hollowed out the shell. It floated away, keratinous armor smoldering, detached tentacles drifting off, giving brief freedom before they, too, expired. The Staff of Life lumbered around, correcting its course and following the Splendid Pinion.
"Match speed to the Staff of Light," said Irwin.
Do not outpace it.
Guns flared along the flanks of the two ships. The void shields of the splendid pinion sparkled as it absorbed thousands of small impacts. The strike cruisers were alone, the rest of the fleet having outpaced the pursuing Tyranids. The Staff of Life could only limp along. Bioships swarmed the two vessels. By dint of sheer firepower, they kept their side approaches clear of aliens, but the real peril came at them from the front, where the two squadrons sent out to intercept the Imperial fleet had reversed course and were now bearing down directly on the strike cruisers.
"My lord,"
asked the servile of the helm. He looked up from his station and the choir of servitors he directed.
"Straight at them. Prepare the warp translation on my mark. Activate Geller fields."
"We shall have to drop the void shields,"
warned the servile Scutus.
"Do it," commanded Erwin.
The Tyranids drew closer. The void shields dropped, exposing the ship to the impact of living torpedoes and balls of bioplasma. The anti-munitions cannons of the vessel worked ceaselessly. The point defense turrets and interception galleries reeked of overheated machinery and were ankle-deep in hot shell casings.
"We're not going to make it," said Ackerman.
He pointed ahead. A shoal of many armed assault beasts was speeding at the vessel.
"Stand firm," ordered Erwin. "Launch torpedoes. Full spreads. Reload. Fire again. Do not stop."
Moments later, the prow ejected six heavy torpedoes of the creatures. The timbre of the ship's voice changed. Complex harmonics overlaid the rumble of the engines.
"Translation in 50 seconds,
intoned a dull machine voice. The soapy sheen of a Geller field appeared around the vessel. There was no communication between the Angels Excelsis and the Angels Numinous ships, but the Staff of Light's actions matched that of their would-be rescuer, and their own warp protection popped into being a moment later, flexing the void around it.
"Translation in 30 seconds.
"We will be torn apart by gravitic shear," said Ackerman. "I advise you to change course, Captain, and make speed for a different translation point." "The chances of survival are only moderately better," said Erwin. "The certainty of death to the Xenos is only increased by our departure from their midst. Make for the center of the interception shoal."
"Translation in 20 seconds.
Thousands of spores, seeds, pods, and living munitions peppered the oculus, mouths sucking and scraping at the armor glass as they slid off. The first round of torpedoes met their target, blasting apart a Kraken ship. The second volley arrived more quickly, the distance between the closing splinter squadron and the escaping cruisers now considerably shortened, but these detonated prematurely, their drives fouled by suicidal creatures and their servitor brains deceived by false information projected by living chaff.
"We're not going to make it. Damn it, Erwin, you've killed us all."
Ackerman placed his helmet back on and loosened his weapons.
"All squads, prepare for boarding parties."
Erwin ignored him. He leaned on the dais rail, hands gripping it so hard the metal bent. There was a chance. Where there was life, there was always a chance. The chance was rapidly diminishing. Already grasping tentacles were unfurling, diamond-tipped appendages flexed, the teeth on their suckers twitching, ready to snare their prey.
"Translation in 10 seconds, said the voice.
"That's it. They have us," said Ackerman.
But as the first tentacle brushed the ship, it recoiled. The Kraken slowed and broke formation clumsily, turning away from the vessel. One sailed dangerously close to the command tower. A vast, moist eye peered hungrily into the ship, and then it was gone.
"Apparently not," said Erwin.
"Translation ready," said the voice.
"Close the shutters," bellowed Erwin. "Brace for translation. Engage warp engines."
The shutters of the oculus descended, smearing the remains of dead Tyranid void organisms across armor glass. Command deck lumens dipped and turned red.
"Brace! Brace! Brace!"
sang a skull-faced servitor with a beautiful voice. The ship's immaterial drive howled at being activated in proximity to so much mass. Reality warping bent perceptions out of true, stretching space-time like spun sugar. The sickening threat of Gellerfield failure teetered on the cusp of realization. The crews of both craft experienced a moment of disassociation, a feeling of being adrift in a sea of monsters far worse than the Tyranids.
Outside, the black cloth of space balled in on itself. In place of the normally smooth creation of a warp rift, the void rumpled into a cluster of holes, and the veil of reality opened like melting plastic sheeting. Multiple smaller rifts sagged open, interspersed by hard knots of compressed reality. The ship sailed on directly towards the central tear of this cancerous fissure. They shuddered as gravity waves rucked up the void. A hard particle sleet of neutrons and gamma bursts slew servitors and burned out electronic systems, but still they plunged on towards the blazing unlight beyond the uneven rift. The effect on the Tyranids was catastrophic. Their ships were scattered like playthings flicked off a blanket. Those closest to the opening tear imploded messily on themselves, compressed into neutronic diamond, or were smeared bloodily across space. With a final wrenching noise that echoed in the souls of all living things present, the Empyrean was revealed. The ships passed out of reality with a violent flare, leaving the interception shoals in shreds. For thousands of miles around their translation point, the Tyranid fleet was decimated. On board the command deck of the Splendid Pinion, Irwin released the dais rail.
"Well done, my servants," he said.
Sparks rained down from on high. The smell of cooked human flesh rose from wrecked servitors. Fires burned unchecked on three galleries at the back, but they had survived.
"Captain," said the servile of response, "I have Vox contact from the Staff of Light. They are firmly in our warp envelope and following."
Irwin looked over to Ackerman. "First Sergeant, you spoke too hastily."
"I did not," said Ackerman, staring ahead. "The Enterprise was reckless.
Yet you admit we are alive, and we have saved a valuable vessel in the process."
"Luck," said Ackerman.
"Maybe."
Irwin stood taller. His pauldrons shifted back.
"You will report to me later for punishment duty." He swept his gaze over his command deck. "Never gainsay me like that again."
Chapter 6. The Archangelion. While the muster gathered, Commander Dante spent much of his waking hours in the throne room at the pinnacle of the Archangelion, a soaring needle-thin tower upon the Ark's Murus. A processional staircase, guarded by statues, wound its way up the tower's hollow center, decorated with a continuous mural 1,000 yards in length, painted only in shades of red, black, and bone. A rich runner, hand-knotted by the Blood Angels themselves, carpeted the stair in a single unbroken length. The rods that held it in place were of pink barlite granite, the stops of platinum. 100,000 bloodstones glinted in the balustrade of the stair. Organ music blasted from the depths with such force it created a swirling draft in the shaft of the stairwell, buffeting the angelic cyber constructs and the servo skulls of loyal blood thralls centuries dead that thronged it. Hundreds of space marines ascended the stairs in slow unison, their steps timed with ritual precision. Dozens of chapter heraldries were evident. Most of the supplicants were chapter lords and captains, chaplains, forge masters, sanguinary priests, and similarly high ranks. Though members of brotherhoods other than the Blood Angels, they were moved by the beautiful singing of the Blood Thralls as much as their hosts were, and hearkened to the teachings of the Blood Angels' chaplains stationed on the stairs' wide landings with as much respect. Mephiston bypassed the ritual line in an unseemly hurry. Rasellus followed. The appearance of the Lord of Death was greeted with a mixture of emotion by the gathering scions of Sanguinius. Many librarians acknowledged him. The reaction of their brothers was less favorable. Mephiston's uncanny presence provoked fear in all men, even in the hardened hearts and minds of the Adeptus Astartes, and though it was but a shifting unease the space marines felt, it was still fear. Of all the sons of Sanguinius, only High Chaplain Astaroth the Grim, Redeemer of the Lost, provoked more loathing. Rasellus felt the wash of emotion, as his master surely must. Mephiston showed not a sign of caring. His will was hard as millennial ice, black as night, and strong as iron. Opprobrium or approbation were equally unimportant to him. Droning chants provided a simple baseline to the complexity of Soaring Plainsong. Proclamations of Sanguinius's purity and responses of loyalty from the Space Marine lords added a rhythm. All were entwined with a rumbling organ music. Unity of purpose and of blood bound music and men together.
If this were only a common happening, thought Rasselas, then naught would stand against us. The galaxy would know peace again.
Rasselas was old, and he had seen many gatherings of the blood, but he was humbled by this unprecedented display of power and piety coiling its way around the Archangelion. Mephiston caught Rasselas's thoughts.
It is impressive, he said aloud.
The blood is strong with us, said Rasselas.
You have spent too long these last weeks cloistered in the diurnal vaults, Rasselas. Venture into the Ark's Murus, and you will see the majesty of the force Dante has summoned.
They arrived at the top of a stair. Blood angels in the golden plate of the sanguinary guard barred a giant set of carved stone doors leading into the throne hall. Two skull-headed angels were depicted in the stone either side of a giant nine picked out in gold, their skeletal hands held up to frame the numeral. At the head of the line waited Castellan Zargo, the chapter master of the angels in Carmine, flanked by his honor guard. Mephiston ignored him.
Let us pass, said Mephiston to the sanguinary guard.
The guardian angel's vox emitter rendered his voice emotionless, at odds with the howling mouth of his death mask.
Lord Commander Dante forbids entry while he is receiving our allies.
He must see us immediately, said Rasselas. We have news regarding the Diamo task force.
I shall contact him when he is done with the lords of the Angels Penitent.
Damn protocol, said Rasselas. This cannot wait.
The Lord of Death stared into the eye lenses of the sentry. Power haloed the Lord of Death's face, the blue witchlight bringing cold accents to the warm gold of the guard's armor.
You will speak with him now.
Very well.
The sanguinary guard fell silent a moment as he communicated on a private channel.
You may enter, O Lord of Death, he said.
The sanguinary guard parted their spears. Mephiston gazed at them with undisguised annoyance as they swung open the soundless doors. The throne room occupied the whole of the tower's pinnacle. Decorated buttresses leaned in from heavily carved walls supporting the dome of stained glass. Floor-to-ceiling windows, 60 feet high, gave views out over the fortress monastery and the host barracked in the desert. Cowled blood thralls stood motionless in recesses between the windows, holding bronze effigies of artists' tools and small representations of their master's weapons. The stone floor was black as the void, its surface flawless and polished to so reflective a shine, it was as if a second inverted dome lurked just beneath its surface. 10 stylized statues of space marines made an inner circle within the room, 5 to represent the angelic graces of honor, humility, mercy, restraint, and forgiveness. Set in opposition were the warrior's virtues of strength, savagery, abandon, rage, and detachment. Where an 11th statue might have stood was the commander's throne. 9 steps of blood-red porphyry led up to a seat far too large for a human being, even a space marine, sheltered under a giant bronze ciborium. Sanguinius spread golden wings and arms behind the throne in an effigy so lifelike he looked as if he might take flight. Another image of Sanguinius sat on the throne, and this one did live. Commander Dante wore the death mask of Sanguinius, and in doing so, became an echo of him. Commander Dante should have looked small and unimportant in a seat sized for a Primarch, but somehow the mask magnified his presence, making a giant of his golden armored form. He was a vessel for Sanguinius's grace, and the light of the Emperor's noblest son shone out of him. On Dante's left stood Corbulo, the sanguinary high priest. On his right was the Paternis Sanguis Ordemale, deputizing for the ever-absent High Chaplain Astaroth. Either side of them were crescent formations of the chapter's highest officials, like blood-red wings. All were bareheaded but Ordemale, whose chaplaincy vows forbade him from removing his helmet in company, and Dante, who habitually hid his face behind that of Sanguinius. 14 space marines knelt at the foot of the stairs,
8 were chaplains, their humility hidden by cast skulls and symbols of death. The rest wore armor that bore too close a resemblance to that of the Death Company for Rasselas's liking. Dark red thorns snaked over the black of their plate. Rasselas felt a deep self-loathing radiating from them, and by extension for the rest of their gene line. Still, they had come to defend Baal. "Rise," commanded Dante. To the purr of armor and the dull noises of metal on stone, the Space Marines stood. "I accept the fealty of the Lords of the Thorns," said Dante. "In the name of our shared blood and the great angel who is father to us all, I welcome you to Baal. I thank you for your presence. As head of the Red Council and of this chapter, I greet you as brothers." Corbulo added his words.
"On behalf of the Council of Bone and Blood, I also thank and welcome you."
The angel's penitent reclusiarch, rather than any of the captains, responded.
"This is the home of our father who made us, and in whose eyes we are all found wanting for our lack of perfection," he said. "In this place we shall stand beside you, Lord Dante, and seek forgiveness for our shortcomings. May the eyes of Sanguinius be on us all, and may he judge us fairly for our faults."
Dante nodded a little, neither agreeing with the sentiment nor denouncing it.
"Go now, Reclusiarch Relion, and prepare for war."
The Space Marines gave thanks and turned from Dante with their heads bowed. The Reclusiarch paused as they passed the librarians, and he looked up and leveled an accusing finger at Mephiston.
"The Emperor condemns," he said. "You should not be here."
"And yet I am," said Mephiston calmly.
The Relion's disgust at Mephiston soured the air. There was a split second where fate held its breath. Rasselas felt Relion come close to attacking the Lord of Death. He clenched his fist.
"May you find the great angel's mercy through an honorable death," he said,
and he walked away. The doors opened, and the Space Marines left.
"Their creed is perverse," said Order Mail, when the doors were safely shut.
Dante sighed and tapped his fist lightly upon the plain stone of his throne. He looked at his hand as he moved it. The blank-eyed stare of Sanguinius regarded the limb as if it were a thing alien to him.
"They are welcome, nonetheless."
The commander summoned his armory thralls and ordered them to remove the golden mask of Sanguinius. His servants wrapped the helmet in red silk and took it away behind the throne. The officers of the chapter waited in silence. Many watched Mephiston closely. Not all of them did so with friendly eyes. Dante's lined face took the place of Sanguinius's perfect features. Dante often said to those closest to him that in wearing Sanguinius's death mask he became the Primarch, in as far as he was perceived by those outside the chapter. When he wore the armor, common humanity and Adeptus Astartes alike saw Sanguinius, not Dante. Maybe there was a deeper truth there than even Dante realized. Without the mask, he appeared too small for the throne, the radiance that shone from him dimmed.
"Now, my Lord of Death, what brings you from the Librarius to the midst of our diplomacy?"
Though Dante was less weary than he had been during the Cryptus campaign, he still rarely showed his face, with good reason. His aged appearance was shocking to those unaccustomed to it. His skin was losing the leatheriness that ancient Space Marines developed, and becoming thin. His cheeks were loose on his skull, wattles hung beneath his chin, and his golden hair had become fine and white.
"We have made contact with the Diamore fleet, my lord," said Rasselas.
He unclipped a scroll case from the belt of his blue armor and walked up the first of the day's steps. He offered the scroll to the chapter master with a short bow.
"Master Leta's message."
"I take it from the dire looks on your faces that the news you have is bad," said Dante.
He reached for the scroll. Mephiston gripped Rasselas's wrist and moved his hand away.
"Wait," said Mephiston. "You must know the circumstances whereby this message came to us are unusual."
"How so?" asked Dante. He withdrew his hand.
"We were opposed by some force, my lord," said Rasselas. "Events gather to a head around the Cadian Gate." "Rasselas, let me tell this story from the beginning," said Mephiston. "There is something of great import at play."
"Do so quickly," said Dante. "Many warriors wait to meet with me, and more are on their way. Time is short, but I will honor them in the correct way."
They deserve courtesy at least in return for their lives.
Mephiston narrowed his eyes.
Then I will be brief. I was struck by a vision. It came to me while I slept in my sanctum. This is unheard of.
Dante looked intently at his chief librarian. Corbulo became attentive.
The vision was sent to me by a member of the Eldari race, continued Mephiston. I was afflicted by foreboding. Attached, I was sure, to Diamore, but when I attempted to scry that system in my dream, I was instead shown Cadia, attacked by a black crusade of unsurpassed size. Billions of foes, both demonic and mortal, issued forth from the eye.
As Astaroth's message informed us, said Brother Incariel,
the master of the blade. His armor was massively enlarged by a Tech Marine's equipment.
These are known factors.
There was more to this than Astaroth conveyed, said Mephiston. I saw Cadia fall, and while I watched, a sense of tragedy unfolding now touched my soul. When I awoke, Epistolary Rassilus and I attempted to find our Diamore task force once again, for it was from there that my first sense of foreboding came. We saw our brothers arrive. The first, second, and elements of the seventh you sent from Cryptus, my lord, broke warp shortly after Astaroth and the Fifth Company. It is good that they did not arrive simultaneously.
Mephiston spoke the next words very clearly, so that none might mistake them.
The Fifth Company was psychically attacked and has fallen to the Black Rage.
Shocked silence greeted Mephiston's news. Dante's head dropped a fraction of an inch, no more than that, but Mephiston saw.
How many are lost to the Rage? He said quietly.
After our vision, said Rosellus, we went to Baal Secundus's relay and focused all the effort of our astropathicum upon Diamore. Shortly after, Master Leta made contact with Codicea Assasmael.
Assasmael lives, said Brother Adonisio, Warden of the Gates.
He was head of the Logisticium, responsible for every detail of a chapter's logistics. He made a note upon the data slate attached by cords to his ornate armor.
What of our astropaths?
The astropaths are dead or driven mad by passage through the warp. The Empyrean is in uproar around the Eye of Terror, explained Rassilus. The situation is far worse than we feared.
How many have fallen to the Rage? Demanded Dante.
As Sasmiel reports, nearly all. The librarians, Astaroth, Captain Sendini, and others, with either protection or great, will have survived.
Rosellus's wrist was released by Mephiston. He offered up the scroll again.
How many were there on the angelic blade in the flame of Baal? Said Dante again.
My lord, said Brother Bellerophon, keeper of the Heaven Gate, Lord Commander of the Blood Angels fleet.
It was the entire Fifth Company.
I...
Give me numbers!
Shouted Dante with sudden fury. The Archangelion fell silent. Half-human things roosting in the buttressing beneath the dome took flight with a clatter of metal wings and squawked prayers. Dante rarely expressed himself so forcefully. Mephiston sensed the rising of the First. Its pernicious psychic influence sparked sympathetic reactions of anger and hunger in all those around the commander.
There were 94 of them, my lord, said Adonisio hesitantly. The demon blades were our only battle company approaching full strength.
Dante's gauntlet clenched, rasping on the stone of his throne.
94, said Dante.
Not all are lost to the Rage, my lord, said Rosellus.
Nearly all, said Dante.
The mechanisms of his armor whined as he pulled himself up in his seat.
This chapter dwindles, Brother Adonisio. What are our numbers of battle-ready brothers?
Adonisio cleared his throat and brought up his ever-present archaeo-ledger to full luminescence.
In the wake of the Cryptus campaign, and now this news, my best calculation is that there are 647 battle brothers at full readiness for war, including our sanguinary priests, the Librarius, Chaplaincy, Dreadnought Ancients, Forge, Tech Marines, and Neophytes. There are 837 in total remaining, from which total 209 members of the First, Second, Fifth, and Seventh are at Diamore.
Less than 50% of our chapter remains here to face the great devourer, said Dante. We call out for aid to others while we send our warriors elsewhere.
He became pensive. Rasselas had never seen him question his own judgment publicly like this, and he felt doubt emanating from the commander.
How many other worlds will fall so that ours has a chance of surviving?
No one answered the question.
Well then, tell me, will Cadia fall? Asked Dante.
I do not know, my lord, said Mephiston. The issuing of the great horde has yet to occur. I cannot trust these visions. Where the future is concerned, it is hard to see the truth. One might see a future that will not come to pass, and of late there have been deliberate attempts to cloud our foresight. Such visions are deceptive under the best of circumstances. The involvement of the alien witch makes me doubt them all the more. It could be a ploy on the part of our enemies to weaken our resolve.
Corbulo stepped forward. Though no true psyker, an element of Sanguinius's foresight touched him too, and his nights were plagued with dark dreams.
The sky shall fall, and a voice in malice call out, Doom! Doom! Doom!
You quote from the scrolls of Sanguinius, said Dante.
Corbulo looked at Mephiston and Dante with haunted eyes.
I do, but I have seen it. I have been seeing it for years. I have heard the voice issuing from the sky.
It is possible that melancholy rather than second sight is the cause of your foreboding, said Brother Bellerophon.
I am a sanguinary priest, Bellerophon. I know the difference. I long hoped that the visions that devil me were the product of imbalance in my humours, a result, perhaps, of minor malfunction in the hormonal systems of my angel's gifts. But I am not troubled in this way. I have tested myself extensively. My sight comes from our Lord, the great angel. I share his curse.
You are not alone, Corbulo. I have had the same vision, said Dante quietly. Before we received Astaroth's message at Diamore, the voice proclaiming doom.
Then the probability increases that these events will come to pass, said Mephiston simply.
If they do, said Rasselas, there is worse to come.
How so? Said Dante.
I do not know, said Mephiston. The sky fell. The Eye of Terror swelled hugely.
Abaddon intends to fly for Terror after all this time, said Bellerophon.
I fear it is more than that, said Mephiston. This is the great enemy's boldest gambit in 10 millennia. They are planning something more terrible than an attack on the throne world, something to do with the Eye.
But what?
Said Ordemail. Mephiston shook his head.
I know not.
Well, then,
said Incariel dismissively. His servo arms twitched.
I regret to say that there is more, said Mephiston, directing a cold look at the Forgemaster. Much more.
Then speak, said Adonisio.
The last is for Dante's ears only.
If there is a further factor of risk, all the chapter lords should be informed, said Adonisio.
Let the Lord of Death keep his silence, Adonisio, said Dante. Attend me later, Mephiston. I will judge who should know what, if it can wait. It can, my lord, said Mephiston. I wish to seek confirmation first.
Very well. In the meantime, give me Master Leta's message, Rasselas.
Mephiston's equerry held out the message tube.
It is a simple message. After he delivered his black tidings, Asasmael spoke of increasing anomalous psychic activity at the Adeptus Mechanicus excavation site on Amethel. In the wake of the task force's losses, he requests reinforcements.
Rasselas offered up the tube again, but Dante held up his hand.
Tell them there are no reinforcements. We cannot spare another warrior.
Yes, my lord, said Rasselas, withdrawing the tube.
Dante looked around at his warriors, meeting the eyes of them all.
None of you are to speak of this with any of the other chapters here present. Do I make myself clear?
The warriors affirmed that he did.
If they reveal visions of their own, do not mention yours. We need every warrior we have to defend our home system.
My lord, said Captain Zedranail of the 8th.
If Cadia falls,
he let the implication hang in the air.
I will not abandon Baal, said Dante.
If Baal falls, the whole of the northern Ultima Segmentum will be open to predation from High Fleet Leviathan.
If the news of Cadia's peril becomes widespread, half our brothers will wish to leave, seeing defense of the Imperium as their prime concern. Half will wish to stay, because, like I, they fear what will happen to the galactic northeast should Leviathan break through our stand. We cannot fight both wars and win. We may lose both if we split our forces.
If you could command them to stay, it would be easier.
That cannot be, Brother Bellerophon, said Dante firmly. I have no authority over them other than that granted by their own consent, and that is by no means yet assured. Authority must be won. Dante's ancient, snow-white brow creased further in thought. When he spoke again, it was with greater certainty. We have a chance to destroy one of the great evils of this age here upon Baal. Should we depart from this course, should half our brother chapters depart and half stay, we will gain nothing and lose everything. That is my judgment, as Sanguinius is my father. By the blood, I will see my orders obeyed. Any who reveal this information to our brothers will face my judgment.
Yes, my lord, said the Space Marines.
Now, my librarians, go about your duties. Mephiston, come to me before the War Council tomorrow and deliver whatever take you must, said Dante grimly. The lords of the angels in Carmine have been patient. Their homage to our chapter must no longer be delayed. The door swung open at Dante's command, flooding the room with song. The word spoke of triumph. None present thought would come. Dante crooked his hand, and Castellan Zaga of the angels in Carmine entered. Chapter 7. The Gathering Host. After a short 5 days in the Imperium, the splendid pinion and the staff of life re-emerged into the material realm, breaking the warp at the Baal Mandeville. Baylor Baal's sun was a medium red star, a common enough type on the fringes of the red scar. From Baal, the scar was a crimson band that stretched from one side of the stellar horizon to the other, its stars smouldering like the eyes of wolves in a dark forest. At full speed, the splendid pinion could have made Baal in a matter of half a day, but as a courtesy, Irwin had his ship match speed with the Staff of Life. Both ships had taken damage in their violent escape from Zozan, and the Staff of Life's unstable drive system was coming close to failure. A loan of transmechanics from Irwin's vessel stabilized matters. As the repairs were undertaken, periodic alarms signaled the arrival of other vessels of the blood translating into Baal. The splendid pinion's detection matrices pronounced the names and classes of friendly vessels it identified in the system, and it did not stop. There were ident beacons ringing out from successor chapters Irwin had never heard of. By the time the Staff of Life was ready to move at a greater speed again, they sailed a crowded void. Upon entering the inner system and contacting the Arx Angelicum's orbital control center, a harassed-sounding servile ordered the splendid pinion and the Staff of Life into close convoy with a dozen other ships. The vessels were given an approach corridor and placed in single line with barely 20 miles between each. So it was that the splendid pinion's view of Baal was obscured by the engine flare of the ship ahead of them. When the tug of Baal's gravity began to work upon the ships, the convoy broke apart and made for their separate anchorages, allowing Irwin, Ackerman, and their brothers assembled upon the command deck to see the triple worlds ahead.
"Baal," said Ackerman reverently, "the home of Sanguinius."
Irwin and his first sergeant stood with their faces bathed in the reflected light of the sun. Baal's moons were so big they barely warranted the name. Baal Primus was paler than its sister, mottled with mountain ranges and smudged with the flat colors of dust seas. Across the pregnant swell of its equator were a series of massive black scars. Four, that must have been 100 miles across, each dominated this grouping of planetary wounds, which together numbered hundreds, odd mountains pimpling their centers. Baal Secundus, slightly smaller, slightly redder, was in respects similar to Baal Primus, though it had the added green and yellow of small toxic seas and the dazzling shine of salt flats that commemorated its vanished oceans. Webs of dead rivers, stark as the veins of an old man, crisscrossed its surface. There were no orbitals around the three worlds, a blessing under the current circumstances, as every anchorage was crowded with ships. The space around Baal played host to flotillas from over a score of chapters. They were strictly ordered, moving in contra-rotating bands so that the three worlds appeared wrapped in wire. Some of the spacefaring brotherhoods had magnificent fleets with dozens of vessels, and it was clear that several chapters were there at full strength. So many scions of Sanguinius had answered the call that good anchorages were contested, and the ships jockeyed for space with barely contained irritation. The orbits around Baal Secundus especially were full. Chapters of the Blood vied to be closest to the place where the foundling Sanguinius had first spread his wings. It was upon the second moon, 10,000 years ago, Sanguinius had inherited a ruined world and saved the benighted populace. Over Baal and Baal Primus there was scarcely more space. Data bursts from a dozen nearby ships flooded the splendid pinion's cogitators, warning them off collision course.
"I have never seen so many space marine attack craft," said Ackerman. "Nor have I, though I do not like to admit my ignorance of such spectacle," said Irwin. "There must be thousands of space marines here," said Ackerman.
"Tens of thousands," said Irwin.
For them both, the thought of being near so many others like themselves was strange and not altogether pleasant. Then there was Baal itself, huge, red, brooding. Deserts blanketed it from pole to pole, where tiny ice caps sat in deference to its modesty. They could serve no other purpose but to spare Baal's embarrassment at its lack of water. They were too small to spawn glaciers, too cold to birth rivers, too isolated to be utilized easily by men. Legend said that Baal was never fully populated, for its moons had been paradises, and it had always been a desert. Unlike the scarred beauty of its satellites, Baal's natural splendor was mostly untouched, save for here and there in the red sands, where the skeletal remains of lost colony cities showed like lace. One place upon Baal exhibited signs of life, and though small from orbit, it stood out in the sterile expanse of desert. Surrounded by lights, heralded by broadcasts on all frequencies of the spectrum, the black spreading mountain that housed the Arx Angelicum was large in every space marine's perception. From orbit, the Arx Angelicum was the merest blemish on the equator, but magnified pict views revealed something of its splendor. Black rock had been carved into imposing art. None of the Arx Angelicum's impressive verticality could be appreciated from that altitude. Everything on a world appears flat as a game board from the void, but the barrels of defense lasers pointing skyward all over the main cone and its secondary companion were a sufficient statement of threat. The Fortress Monastery was a place of great power. No spacefaring visitor could overlook that. To the space marines flocking to the world, the fortifications were the least of the Arx Angelicum's qualities. Baal was a spiritual home to every transhuman in the fleet, no matter how far they had strayed from the grace of their forefather, and some had strayed far indeed. The Arx Angelicum was a reminder of Sanguinius's actuality, that the great angel was no myth, that he had once been, that he had walked and fought and died for the dream of the Imperium. Sanguinius himself had built that fortress, and he had dwelt there. At the sight of it, those chapters who had forgotten something of their heritage felt their love for Sanguinius shine anew, while those who still held their lord in their hearts were smitten with near-religious awe. Relations between Sanguinius's sons remained close. Their curse was their bond. Hundreds of those present had been to Baal on pilgrimage or missions of amity. However, thousands of the warriors had not, and on many ships of many colors, hardened warriors wept to see the world of their gene-father for the first time. Magnified further, rows and rows of space marine tanks were visible on the uncovered landing fields, as was the industry disturbing the desert for miles around the arcs.
"I've seen the Tyranid swarm with my own eyes," said Ackerman. "Until this moment I thought we had no hope of beating them. But we might. We just might."
Irwin and Ackerman watched for an age, unwilling to tear themselves away from the spectacle. A harsh burst of static interrupted their silence. A voice, its words indistinct but its tone angry, blurted out from a vox station in the communications section.
"My lord, we are being hailed by the Blade of Vengeance," called the servile of response.
Irwin frowned.
"Captain Asante?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Let us have him, then," he gestured. "Main hololith."
Asante swam hugely into life over the main hololith pit. His armor was bedecked in honors and bloodstone. His face was stern.
"Captain Asante, to what do I owe this honor?" said Irwin, though he could guess.
Asante maintained a neutral expression.
"Captain Irwin, I demand you present yourself upon the Blade of Vengeance."
"For what purpose?" said Irwin, though he guessed that too.
"I would like you to explain to me why you disregarded my orders and went to the aid of the Staff of Light rather than falling into formation with the rest of my task force."
Irwin smiled fixedly.
"I shall be glad to attend you. I accept your invitation, Captain Asante, but you have no right to summon me."
Irwin nodded at the servile of response, and Asante was cut off as he was opening his mouth to speak again.
"Prepare my Thunderhawk," ordered Irwin.
Ackerman pointed at Irwin's armor. His colors were scruffed and scratched. Alien blood caked the deeper recesses.
"Are you not going to clean your war gear before you meet him?"
"That would undermine the point I'm going to make," said Irwin.
"Good luck," said Ackerman.
"It is he who will require luck," said Irwin. "The Angels Excelsis take orders from none but themselves. In any case, you can watch, because you are coming with me. Orsini, keep things in order while we're gone. Servile," he called to his armory servant, "bring us our weapons. We shall speak to this captain armed."
Irwin's Thunderhawk wove its way through crowded space. Smaller craft sped between the vessels of the gathering host, taking emissaries between chapters to reaffirm old alliances and strike new ones. From the largest ships went streams of landing craft, ferrying men and material to the surface. Everywhere there was activity, and the Vox was overwhelmed with a chatter of 24 separate military organizations attempting to establish some sort of order between themselves.
"It looks like a legion," thought Irwin, "of the sort from the old histories. But it is not. If only it were. There is no unity here."
There was no central command structure, no order of deference to be observed, no hierarchy. Each chapter was semi-autonomous within the Imperium, beholden to the commands of its master, and no one else. Very few individuals or organizations could order the Space Marines to do anything. Although all of them respected Commander Dante as the eldest living Space Marine commander, and his position as Lord of the Founding Chapter granted him authority, technically all the chapter masters were of the same rank as he. The situation was even more complicated at captain level. A Space Marine captain was expected to make decisions with little guidance. For much of the time, they operated alone upon their own initiative. There were hundreds of them at Baal, and they had no command structure to coordinate their actions. That was why Irwin must go to Asante and stand his ground. The Blade of Vengeance dominated the space around it. Orbital control of the Arx Angelicum did its best to group ships by chapter. The Blade was attended by three of the Blood Angel strike cruisers and a number of escorts. Its blood-red livery was striking, its shade of red more violent, more sanguinary than all the other reds around it. Irwin shook his head. His mind was playing tricks. How was the red of the Blood Angels any more vibrant than that of the Blood Swords? How was it more arresting than the deep red and black of the Flesh Terrors? That kind of thinking was why Asante thought he could order Irwin about. The idea of Blood Angels as preeminent had to be challenged. Even so, Irwin could not shake a sense of awe as his Thunderhawk flew along the metal cliffs of the Blade of Vengeance's flanks. It was a magnificent ship, and ancient, dating back to the Heresy. One of the first of its class, and among the most powerful, its gun decks and towers were festooned in glorious sculpture chased with gold and precious metals. Large panels were painted with stupendous battle scenes. It was a scarred beauty. The freshest wounds were inflicted by acid, bioplasma, and claw, but these marks of the Cryptus campaign were overlaid upon older damage, some of it so deep the art of the Blood Angels could not conceal it. The damage did not detract from the ship's grace. Instead, it accentuated its magnificence and its deadliness, like dueling scars on the face of a beautiful female warrior. The Blade of Vengeance had taken everything the galaxy had to throw at it for 10,000 years, and it had survived in glory. The flight deck entrances were located in the stubby wings projecting from the side of the main section. In this and other regards, battle barges were similar to strike cruisers, with the same overall body design of main hull and a projecting neck housing gun batteries and turrets that ended in a flat-headed prow. But they were so much bigger. Extra flank shielding sheltered the flight decks and the reactor core. Irwin's craft flew behind the shields, out of the light, and into a dark, saturated with bloody tones by the red scar, Baal,
and the ship's arterial livery. Atmospheric shielding flickered over his ship, and he came into the brightness once more. His Thunderhawk put down on a landing square in the hangar.
"Welcome to the Blade of Vengeance, Captain Irwin," said a human voice. "You may disembark."
Irwin ordered the ramp lowered and strode out, Ackerman and himself flanked by a pair of Excelsior guardians clad all in white. He noted straight away that the grav plating was set higher than the Angel's Excelsis ships, mimicking Baal's great mass. A human servile waited for Irwin at the foot of the ramp. Armed shipmen stood in a perfect square behind him, their heavy lasguns held to attention.
"My lord," the human dipped his head, "I am Corvail, third deck captain and blood thrall to the Blood Angels chapter. My lord Asante regrets that none of the brothers were available to greet you, but it is unfortunately unavoidable. Our chapter is presently under strength. Many of my lords are deployed elsewhere. As you can see, we have a great many tasks to accomplish."
"Our chapter?" thought Irwin. One of his own serviles would never have dared refer to the Angels Excelsis that way. And a captain? There was no meek deference in this Corvail. He was confident, daring to look at Irwin as if he were almost an equal. Irwin hid his astonishment. His irritation was harder.
"My thanks, third deck captain."
Corvail bowed deeply. It was a small balm to Irwin's outrage. Servitors came to the Thunderhawk, clamping track units around its landing claws that raised the ship up off the deck. The tracks squealed, and the Thunderhawk lurched off in the direction of a holding bay. Corvail followed Irwin's eyes.
"Your ship will be ready to leave when you are, my lord."
"Impertinent," thought Irwin.
"Take me to your master," he said.
"As you wish."
Corvail turned smartly about. The Angel's Excelsis followed, and the human shipsmen formed up around them. Corvail was not lying about the number of space marines present. They marched down deserted corridors. Ammunition transports rumbled past on their way to and from the ship's vast magazines, but the only people they saw were servitor half-men and their barely more human Adeptus Mechanicus creators. Space marine craft had small crews for their size, most of them being servitors watched over by human serfs and commanded by space marines. It was unbelievable to Irwin to have the likes of Corvail with so much authority. He should have seen at least a few fellow space marines. They went deeper into the ship, towards the command spires. Only when they reached a bank of giant lifters, situated at a nexus in the spinal corridor, did he see a solitary Blood Angel standing watch. Ornate doors of red marble slid back. They were beautifully carved, as was the interior they revealed.
"This way, my lord," said Corvail, gesturing to the empty lifter.
They ascended many floors to the uppermost decks, passing the command center. The lift stopped near the top of its run, and Irwin's party was led into a lofty hall whose walls, floor, and ceiling were covered in polished stone of black, red, and cream. Inside he found a dozen Blood Angels, a single squad and a couple of Sanguinary Guard, whose armor and gear mirrored Irwin's Excelsior Guardians in all but color. There was a high throne in the hall, upon a platform held off the paving by a cunningly balanced stair. The thought of Asante lecturing him from that vantage made Irwin angry, but it appeared that the captain would not, for it was covered in a red banner bearing the chapter badge. The Blood Angels parted, revealing Asante.
"You," said Asante, without introduction, "I ordered you to follow my lead. Why did you not?"
Irwin removed his helmet before answering, letting the hiss of pressure equalization fill the space of words. He looked upon a man who was similar in appearance to himself. Sanguinius's gene seed reworked its bearer strongly. There was a genuine family resemblance in the chapters.
"Because you have no right to order me," said Irwin. "I am not of your chapter. Even if I were, I am a company captain. You have no company. I would not submit to another captain's authority without direct orders from my own chapter master."
"So you disobeyed," began Asante.
"Disregarded is how you put it before," interrupted Irwin. "That is more accurate."
"You disregarded my orders to make a point," said Asante.
"I disregarded them because you did not give me the complete picture. I saw a ship in danger. We could not communicate. How was I to know the Staff of Life was a decoy?"
"It was an obvious tactic," said Asante.
"One I disagree with. To be frank, had I known, I would have acted the way I did anyway. In the end, I extricated the ship and myself. You could have done the same."
"If I had,
I would have risked my entire task force. You put two ships in danger and your company. The destruction of Zoes and Tertius was under my command.
I came to a call for aid, said Erwin. I aided you as I saw fit.
Asante frowned and took a data slate from an attendant blood thrall.
Upon this slate are triple verified prognostications for casualty reports if my plan had been followed. Within it also you will see the chances of success for your self-appointed mission. You will note they are low.
Erwin ignored the slate.
I acted on my own judgment, as is my right. You cannot complain about my exercising my Emperor-given authority as a captain of the Adeptus Astartes.
I would not, had you not put my entire operation at risk.
Erwin laughed.
Nonsense! I put my company at risk, not you or your ships. Our chances of escape would have been higher had you obeyed.
You escaped anyway, said Erwin, thanks to me. Henan of the Angels Numinous lives to retell the story of your victory. Had it not been for my so-called disobedience, he would have been dead and a valuable ship lost.
Now I see more to disagree with you about. You call this a victory? Said Asante. Your mission was to deprive the high fleets of biomass, I assume. You enacted exterminatus?
Erwin shrugged.
Then your mission was a success. 500 million Imperial citizens are dead by our hand, said Asante.
His face flushed. He stepped in close to the Angel Excelsis. He was bigger and heavier than Erwin, but Erwin would not be intimidated.
500 million lives we were sworn to protect. Their world, a valuable, viable world, is no more. They called for help before the shadow fell on them. They would have seen us arrive as the High Fleet invested their planet, thinking their prayers answered and their lives saved. But die they did, and the last sight they had was of a Blood Angel's warship opening fire upon them, said Asante. We did not have time to evacuate them or to even explain our actions fully. There are no successes in this fight, only degrees of failure. Impetuous warriors like you increase the severity of those failures.
You are attempting to distract yourself from your guilt by railing at me. I expected more from the Blood Angels.
And I expect more respect from a brother in arms. I suggested a course of action that was logical and had the higher parameter of success.
What can I say? Said Erwin. I enjoy bad odds.
Asante stared at him.
Please, do not become angry, brother, said Erwin. I agree, we need a command structure. If commanded to do so by my own lord, I will follow you without question, but you have no right to assume I will follow you because you are of the Father chapter. A hierarchy based on so flimsy a premise will not withstand the rigors of war. You presume too much because you wear the colors of Sanguinius, my brother.
Asante scowled.
Your efforts to save the Staff of Light are appreciated, but folly. Saving it is to be commended. Missing two ships would have been the poorer result, and it was far more likely. Do not risk yourself in that manner again.
I have said that you cannot command me, said Erwin.
Then you will die alone. We must work in concert if we are to prevail. Commander Dante will show you the way.
No agreement has been made yet, said Erwin.
Someone has to take command, said Asante. We could be wrangling over this for months. If we do not make our own agreements when needed, we will die. If this situation ever occurs again, I advise you to do as I say, or die as you will. All that matters to me is that Baal is saved. I hope you will choose the better option, so you might help in the defense, rather than throwing your life away.
Erwin frowned.
Why are you being this way? Why do you challenge my authority in front of my second?
I have commanded fleets against the Tyranids 11 times, said Asante. I fought at Cryptus, where the swarm was bigger than any we've seen before. What is your experience, brother?
Sufficient, said Erwin. I do not have to listen to this rebuke. It is unworthy of both of us.
He replaced his helmet and motioned to his men to leave. It was good no one tried to stop him. In the mood he was in, Erwin would have fought.
Captain, called Asante. Erwin paused. I hear they paused in their assault during your escape.
Why? Said Asante. Only Henan could have told you that. Ungrateful wretch, reporting on me to you.
Did it happen or not?
We drove them off. It is simple, said Erwin.
They never retreat. Never. Do you know that, Captain Irwin? That is not my experience, Captain. Really, I advise you to check your ship for signs of infiltration, said Asante. You may be carrying gene stealers, or worse. There are no infiltration organisms on my ship. None at all, said Irwin.
He made to go again, then stopped and turned back.
The people you mourn, they would have died anyway, said Irwin. They died quickly. Their bodies remain upon a world sanctified by their death. They will not provide reinforcements to our foe. The very stuff that makes them did not have to endure the most wicked form of slavery I have ever encountered. Forgive me, Blood Angel, but in my chapter, the destruction of Zozan Tertius would be regarded as a success. Get out, said Asante. Irwin saluted, making the Aquila over his heart. I will see you on the field again, I am sure.
The Angels Excelsis boarded the elevator again under the unfriendly stare of the Blood Angels.
You say that I have no faith in my abilities, said Ackerman. Your problem, my brother, is that you have too much confidence in your own.
Irwin hissed theatrically. Ackerman looked sidelong at him.
One day, said the sergeant, you're going to get us all killed, Captain.
The pod's inhabitant extruded its sticky foot from its shell. A set of razor claws, composed of a synthesized mineral, punched through its skin. The claws were intended to be used once, and had no exit from their sheaths but through the flesh of the pseudopod, destroying it in the process. The claws snapped out in a welter of fluid that froze in the voidal cold. A frenzied twisting of dying muscles sent them slicing into the resin, sealing the pod to the hull of the splendid pinion. The pod convulsed and shook. Limbs trapped inside calciferous cavities beat hopelessly at their prisons, shaking the pod loose of the weakened resins, and it drifted free. Sensing beasts came alive. A rich flood of prey sign-swamped the pod's secondary brain. In seconds, it had processed multiple streams of data, identifying the target fixed in its memory by the greater hive mind, and calculated the best trajectory to land unseen. The last propellant gases were expended, moving the pod away from the prey vessel and leaving it at the mercy of fate. Sophisticated baffles screened the pod's descent through the crowded sky. Voidcraft gravity wakes perturbed its flight, threatening to cast it uncontrolled into the well of Baal Primus. With emotionless calm, the pod shifted fluid between internal bladders, correcting its fall. It would have died with equal phlegmatism. Into the upper reaches of Baal's atmosphere it fell, going from the killing chill of the void into the cold night of the southern dune ocean. Atmospheric friction scorched the hard, wrinkled exterior of the craft, cooking alive the lesser sub-creatures clinging to the shell. They died in silent agony, robbing the pod's brains of sight, hearing, smell, and every other sense, one by one. The pod's grasp on the prey's position slipped away as it fell into sightless dark. The meaningless electromagnetic pulses booming from the metal-shelled craft of the prey were the last to go silent, and then the pod was isolated from everything but the burning heat of the air. Terminal impact smashed the pod's primary brain to mush and wrenched the secondary from its cellular bindings. Floating free in draining fluids, it twitched its vestigial limbs for the first and final time. Stimulant hormones flooded both the pod and its occupant. This last act accomplished, the secondary brain died, not caring about its own demise or that its mission had been accomplished. Sand blew over the steaming shell. The pod was an insignificant speck in a plain of undulating sand, black in Baal Secundus's moonshine. Minutes passed with no sign of activity. The pod was already beginning to disappear under the drifting sand. A wet crack heralded a false birth. Seams, ropey with thick mucus, burst open along the quarter lines of the hull, spasmed, then splayed wide. From within, a tall, gangling creature staggered out. Unsteady as a newborn animal at first, but within a few steps, it was striding confidently into the night. It unfolded multiple limbs, its great killing talons lifting high and opening upward. It cast back its head and tasted the air.
Glowing eyes looked skyward. Tentacles moved beneath an alien skull in place of a mouth. The lictor scanned the area with multiple senses. Hitting upon what it sought, it turned sharply on its hooves and galloped off. Its outline flickered, and it vanished into the dark.
Chapter 8. The Octo Calvarii. There were places in the Carceri Arcanum that actively denied the working of technology. Mephiston paused at the border of one, took up a torch of rare resinous barley and wood from a rack, lit it with a small fusion torch hanging by a chain from the crumbling brickwork, and went deeper within. Firelight supplemented the weak glow of the biolumen globes riveted to the vaulted ceiling. Water dripped from somewhere ahead. Baal was as dry as bone dust. The liquid came from some other place and time. No one knew who had built the Carceri Arcanum. They were some of the oldest parts of the fortress monastery, if not the oldest. It had been suggested they predated the volcano they burrowed under. But they were of brick, and seemed to have been made by human hand, whereas the volcano is estimated to be over 7 million years old. The tunnels had many peculiar qualities. If mapped against Baal's physical terrain, they should have gone miles outside the Ark's Murus, but there was no sign of them. Once a curious librarian had ordered a pit dug into the desert sands where the tunnels should surely be. He found the ruins of a defense complex abandoned after the sundering of the Legion, and no tunnels. Many mysteries were attached to the Carceri Arcanum, but only one certainty, and that was that they were anomalous in every respect. They resonated with the warp, amplifying the power of the Librarius. Because of this affinity, Mephiston held court in the circle of consonants at their center, where his quorum empiric met to discuss matters of sorcery and the soul. The Carceri Arcanum served a further useful purpose. Deep underground, only partially contained within mundane reality, and with a fierce source of empirical energy to tap, they were a fine place to house the chapter's most dangerous relics. The tunnel that Mephiston took led away from the center of the labyrinth down one of its lengthy spurs. Short corridors curved off the passageway, their shadows resistant to his torch. In those corridors, adamantium doors barred cells where ancient weapons languished. A sword which slew any foe, but that kindled the black rage swiftly in its wielder.